everyone. I'm Lori Boyer, and it's time for the My Ag Life Daily News Report. To start us off here today, listen in as Blue Diamond Growers Mel Machado discusses how last year's dry summer and fall affected almond trees in today's episode of My Ag Life in Almonds. And that report starts right after this. This segment is sponsored by Bee Vectoring Technology. To sign up for a field trial, email contact at beevt.com.
Through last fall, the National Drought Monitor categorized much of the state, including the Central Valley, as being in an exceptional drought. And those prolonged dry conditions may have taken a toll on almond trees, according to Mel Machado, who's vice president of member relations for Blue Diamond Growers.
The dry fall really was compounding what went on during the summer here. During the summer, for those that were short on water, we were watching stress levels rise due to increased salinity, high pH water where they did have water that was of not great quality, and just these stress levels as far as, in the worst cases, defoliation. And you really have to wonder what's going on with the bud tissue and bud development as these buds differentiate. So I think that's what we're going to see is, while the stresses were obvious in a lot of blocks, those stresses are going to continue to manifest themselves in the coming bloom.
Machado said almond growers saw some relief in December when a series of storms brought much-needed rain to the valley. As of January 1, rainfall totals were 130% of average for Bakersfield, up to 140% of average for Chico. Sierra's snowpack was 160% of average, according to the first of the season Department of Water Resources snowpack survey.
Yeah, atmospheric rivers, I always chuckle at that term because they used to be called Pineapple Expresses, so there's always a new term for everything. The idea of that rainfall coming across the valley is really beneficial for the orchards in the near term because it helps replenish, and it really did replenish the root zones in just about every case, even down into the South Valley. Good moisture levels down the root zones, but I'll say more importantly, leaching out some of those toxins, some of those salts that have accumulated over the last 2 years where people might have been just short enough on water where they were not having a leaching component. Up here in the northern end of the San Joaquin and then the Sacramento Valley, definitely helpful here. A lot of growers don't realize you really need moisture in that root zone. And I've always felt that if you normally have 6 inches of rain, and just to pick a number, by Christmas time, and this year you didn't get it, make an irrigation. If you have water available, make an irrigation. And I was reading a study here a few weeks ago that one of the researchers was talking about winter irrigations and what was needed to just really maintain orchard health. And it even goes to support nectar flows during the bloom, which is important for that following crop. So the rainfall we got here off these December rains is really well-timed, and thank you for it. If you look at where we're at now in reservoir status, we're in pretty good shape as far as our snowpack and where we are for this point in time. However, if it stops, we don't get any more rain or more snow, we're still in deep trouble. We don't have enough to get us through the year here adequately. So we need to continue to get rainfall and, more importantly, snowpack to really give us adequate supplies of water to get through the growing season.
In addition to adequate moisture, almond trees need at least 400 chill hours during the winter. A chill hour is 60 minutes of temperatures between 32 and 45 degrees. This puts them in a deep sleep and helps promote a stronger bloom.
I have to admit, I've yet to really check the chill hours. I looked at them real quickly in a couple of stations 2 weeks ago, and we were okay. Nothing fancy, nothing really great, but we were okay. We were as good as we have been in recent years. We finally had a killing frost last week. And I say killing frost to kill the darn flies that drive you crazy at this time of year. Fortunately in almonds, we do not need the really deep, deep chilling that some other crops do, like cherries. And some of these really warm, balmy winters, as you call them, I've been in cherry orchards where there was not one fruit. They just did not get a good bloom. We get by with a lot less chilling requirement on these trees. A few hundred hours, I'd say 400 hours below 45 is good too. One of the considerations with chilling though is you can have a good low temperature. You can get down 29 degrees, 30 degrees in the morning. But if you have bright sun in the afternoon, you'll literally unwind those chilling hours that you accumulated at night just because that radiant heat on that wood. And growers don't understand that. And I'll tell them, let's go outside and sit on the tailgate of the pickup. And pretty soon you watch them starting to strip that coat off because that sun beating on them is getting warm. And that's when I'll make the point, this is what's happening to your trees too. So chill portions, as they call it, is really something we need to be looking at. And we've been okay, but we also are thinking, not really sure what's going on here, that we may have some varieties that are a little less tolerant of low chilling, and we're seeing some strange growth, some strange reactions in the trees because of this potential for low chilling.
Although orchards are mostly quiet during the winter, many growers put their shakers back in to remove mummies, those nuts left over after harvest. The goal is to remove overwintering habitat for navel orangeworms, considered the number one insect pest of almonds. University of California Cooperative Extension recommend growers strive for fewer than two mummies per tree. In the south part of the valley, where navel orangeworm threat tends to be heavier, they encourage growers to target one mummy per tree.
Winter sanitation is the foundation for an effective control program in navel orangeworm. With navel orangeworm, really what you want to do is reduce the amount of inoculum, the amount of larvae that are in that orchard during the wintertime so that they don't reproduce during the growing season. If you do not clean those orchards up, get those mummies out of the trees, get them on the ground, get them into a windrow, and then destroy them with a flail and mower, you're going to have increased issues. Dr. Siegel at the USDA has got some information, and forgive me, I don't remember off the top of my head here, but he can document the percent of infestation in the following crop for the number of ground nuts, the number of mummies that are on the ground that have not been destroyed. So it's not just a matter of getting them on the ground. Growers will ask me, well, can I just shake them and will it be okay? The mortality is higher because things don't go well in that environment on the orchard floor, particularly if the stuff's within the cover crop or within the weeds in the orchard floor. Because it's a very humid, wet condition, but they can still survive. Navel orangeworm are tough insects in the larval stage, and they're strong flyers in the adult stage. So really what we want to do is, with prejudice, destroy those mummies, take them out. And the reason for that is with in-season sprays, a lot of us believe, and I'm the primary believer in this, that due to the inefficiencies of timing and the inefficiencies of application, that any of our in-season treatments really just take out about half the test pop or half that population. So if you start up here, you know, my hand over my head, and you take out half, you still have too many. If I can drop that inoculum down, drop the number of larvae out there, the number of navel orangeworm in the field, drop it down by sanitation, then my in-season sprays become just that much more effective. So really, it's like links in a chain. You've got the foundation of sanitation, mummy shaking and mummy destruction, really looking closely at mating disruption, really thinking there's a lot of value and potential in mating disruption, wanting to get small growers to work together to incorporate mating disruption programs, because we know disruption works on large blocks. It doesn't work as well on small orchards. Kind of like growing a row of sweet corn. You're not going to get good ears of sweet corn if you just plant a row. So you really need to be, I'll say, larger than 20 acres in most instances before disruption becomes effective. If I can get neighbors to work together and make a bunch of these 10 and 20 acre orchards into hundreds of acre orchards, that will help. And then effective timing on applications of in-season sprays, and maybe even not eliminate in-season sprays, but maybe even reduce them because of all the good things you've done ahead of time. This would be beneficial for growers.
Almonds are typically the first crop to bloom in the valley. Although actual timing depends on the weather, the variety, and the location, Machado said we can expect it in February.
You know, traditionally, in fact, my marketing people were always saying, okay, when's bloom going to start? About the 10th of February, okay? Now, I remember one year, several years back, where I had full bloom, and I'll say full, that means peak bloom. There's no such thing as 100% open flowers in the trees. But we had full bloom on the 8th of February on the west side of I-5 and several orchards up in Colusa County. It was just strange. But peak bloom is ordinarily right about the last weekend of February, and we're normally done by the 10th, 12th of March.
Machado just returned from the American Beekeepers Federation annual meeting in Las Vegas, where bee supply and health was one of many discussions. In February, about 70% of the nation's bees are in California almonds working for about a 6-week period. That's about 1.6 million bee colonies.
Interesting question, because yesterday morning in the Q&A session, they asked me exactly what was going to happen here, and quote, the difference between the bees available and the bees required. And I spun it around and said, I'm here to ask you, what do you have in supply? And nobody would answer the question. So at this point, we believe it's adequate. There's nothing that says it's not adequate. One thing I did point out with them was the acreage, potential acres of self-fertile varieties that growers believe don't need bees. I believe you need to put some bees on these self-fertiles. But there's quite a few acres out there potentially. And again, nobody really knows because the USDA data is so weak. Growers aren't really, really good at reporting what they planted by variety. But you can make a good argument for 250,000 acres out of 1.6 in total. And let's just say 250,000 acres out of 1.3 that's bearing. That would significantly reduce the bee requirement in total.
Next on the show, Taylor Chalstrom will have an update from the Western Agricultural Producers Association's Priscilla Rodriguez on the Food and Drug Administration's Produce Safety Rule water compliance requirements. Let your bees carry a beneficial biofungicide directly to flowers and reduce brown rot blossom blight and jacket rot. Sign up for a field trial of bee vectoring and the biofungicide Vectorite with CR7 on your almond orchard. Deadline is January 15th for setup and use at the start of your February bloom. Email contact at beevt.com. The Musco Family Olive Company is leading the transformation of the table olive industry. We are committed to the California olive grower and invite you to grow with our family. Modern table olive orchards apply newly perfected state-of-the-art planting and harvesting to one of the world's oldest tree crops for proven superior results. There is opportunity in any crop transition, and Musco is proud to offer long-term contracts and free trees to our grower partners. Visit us at the Agro Malora booth at the upcoming Calusa Farm Show and the World Ag Expo. See you there.
In the last month of 2021, the Food and Drug Administration announced they would postpone the Food Safety Modernization Act's Produce Safety Rule water compliance requirements, subpart E, which was set to begin this month. The FDA intends to exercise enforcement discretion for the agricultural water requirements for covered produce while proposing changes to the current water requirements. Priscilla Rodriguez, Director of Regulatory Affairs and Food Safety from Western Agricultural Processors Association, explains the FDA's reasoning behind this postponement.
Originally, it was back in 2017 when FDA originally postponed the compliance dates or extended the compliance dates for the water subpart for the produce safety rule to begin January of this year. So January 2022 is when they were supposed to begin. Although at the time, our inspections have actually been occurring for the past couple of years. So everything but the water requirement was in play already. So you had to have to be in compliance, and the inspections were already happening. They were making sure that you were in compliance with all the other portions of the rule, except for the water requirement, because that didn't kick in until 2022. Now, back in 2018, 2019, FDA, actually sooner than that, FDA did hold public meetings on the proposed rule. The water requirements itself received a lot of pushback from stakeholders, both nationally and internationally, because anybody that brings in imports in produce into the U.S. has to also follow the produce safety rule. So there was a lot of pushback on the water requirements because of it, its need for a large amount of water testing. So because of that, it got pushed back. Now, FDA said that they were working on this to try to make a change to those water requirements, and they hadn't come out with anything yet. So right before the deadline, right before it was about to begin, people were going to need to start testing or figuring out what they needed to do to be in compliance. FDA comes out and says that they now have a new proposed water requirement. So they did release that as well in December, and said that you don't need to begin water testing, because now they are looking at pushing forward this new proposed water requirements, which was set out in December.
FDA's intentions for these proposed revisions addressed a major issue, the requirement of water testing across multiple farms. Rodriguez noted that this would have become very expensive very fast if implemented.
in the previous proposed rule, you had to have what was called a microbial water quality profile, MWQP. And what that was that was a rolling data set of your water testing from all your different water sources. So for example, if I was a farm and I had 10 water sources, 10 wells on my farm, I had to test those 10 wells. I should change that. I do five and five. So five wells, which is underground water, right? And then you have surface water. So if you have groundwater, surface water, those are different types of sources. So dependent on what kind of sources one you had and the number amount of sources you had to test those. And if you consider, for example, somebody who has five groundwater sources, you'd have to test that four times within 1 year to get that profile for each of those sources. So there you're looking at four times five, so 20 tests in 1 year for just those five sources. Now, if you also had five sources that were surface water, then you had to do you had to have 20 for those five. So you look at that, those five, just to create the profile, you'd have to have 100 tests alone just to create that profile. So now you're looking at, 120 tests just creating the profiles. And then every year thereafter, you're doing one test for your five, and then you're doing four tests for your other sources. So it was excessive really fast. And then when you look at, you know, some farms have more than 10 sources. So it does, it wasn't practical at all. And so FDA actually, you know, listened to the concerns of folks and decided they were going to make that change. So the intention of this is to change that, remove that water testing. So now you're no longer required to do water testing. It's still an option for you. So what they did now is they said, okay, you get this opportunity to do an assessment of your practices of your farm and determine the best way to mitigate and ensure that you have safe water to ensure a safe food product. So they give you the opportunity to say, okay, you do your assessment, determine what is the best practice for your farm, instead of just giving this really arbitrary number and determining that you, by doing this, you're going to have safe water, which necessarily doesn't necessarily mean that would be the case. By testing so many times doesn't mean you're going to have safe water. So it really just takes that out and provides more flexibility for the farm to determine what those issues may be and how to solve them. Now, testing can still be part of it. Those methods can still be used to determine that your water is safe to use, but it doesn't require or mandate that.
As for what the use of assessments compared to testing changes for growers, Rodriguez said it really just offers the grower more flexibility in their water practices.
You know, part of the problem is that there's, when you look at this, this is a national global regulation. And when you try to do one set of one method of determining whether you have safe water or not, it's really difficult to cover everybody, right? So this here really just provides flexibility for folks and lets them determine what is going to be the best practice for them. So it's really that flexibility that it gives the growers and lets you decide. So if you do, as you do in your assessment, you determine that you, what you need to do is X, Y, and Z, you have the ability to do X, Y, and Z to make sure that you have safe water practices and not just using this arbitrary number of water testing to determine that.
FDA's main grab for these water assessments is the fact that it's adaptable. You're really just looking at water sources across the board instead of just one source on the farm.
And when you're doing this assessment, you're identifying conditions or hazards. So this is very similar to kind of what the produce safety rule already has in place for their sanitation. So they did a similar approach where they, in sanitation, they said, okay, we're not going to tell you what your sanitation methods need to be or the frequency that you need to do it. You figure that out. You do your assessment, figure out what's appropriate for your farm, and you practice those methods. It's not up to us to tell you, because again, you look at, you know, the different amount of commodities, the different farm practices, it's difficult to say you need to do sanitation this way and you need this amount of time. So this approach, again, is provide the flexibility. So you look at your water, you look at your farm, you look at the area, you assess the area and determine what you need to do to address the problem. So part of that is making sure that once you've addressed those, where those problems are, is that you actually have corrective actions and mitigation steps to take care of that, right? So it's not just, okay, well, I looked around and I determined you know, these points A, B, and C are an issue. Okay, great. You did that. Now, how do we make sure that A, B, and C are not going to be a problem? What are those corrective actions? Is it testing? Is it treating the water? Is it using different water sources? What is that corrective action? And then if those correction actions don't work, what other mitigation steps that you can take to make sure that there's no that potential for contamination in that water? And then the other one, which is kind of, is really already part of the produce safety rule, is determining adjacent land use and what adjacent land use can have effect on your farm. So that is another thing that the another key provision of the rule is making sure that you're not only looking at your farm, but the adjacent farms and how that can contribute to water contamination on your farm.
Since the revisions are being postponed, there will be an opening for public and industry comment.
As part of the process, FDA opens, you know, releases the proposed rule, opens this up for public comments. Public comments or written comments can be submitted all the way through April 5th of this year. So there's plenty of time for written comments to be provided by individuals, by industry. Also, FDA is going to be holding two virtual public meetings. Typically, they're, you know, in person, but given everything with COVID, they're virtual this year, and they have come out with the dates. The dates for those are February 14th, and I believe it is 25th, and you can now register for those. So if you're interested in submitting verbal comments or just listening in on other comments, you definitely have the opportunity to provide FDA with your feedback on the new proposed rule that was just released.
During the postponement, Western Ag Processors Association will also be taking a deeper dive into the regulations.
We will be providing both written and public comments, oral comments at the meetings, and we definitely will make sure that we're representing our membership through this process.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
In regional agricultural news, a huge part of the industry's efforts involve preparing the next generation of agricultural leaders, and Western Growers is one organization at the helm of these efforts. Most recently, Western Growers was awarded a $750,000 grant from the California Department of Food and Agriculture's 2021 Specialty Crop Block Grant Program. An estimated 2,750 students will be assisted by the program, which will include the specialized training of 330 next-gen ag workforce professors. Walt Duffleck, Vice President of Innovation with Western Growers, says this grant gives them a chance to create new programs statewide to develop the key skills students need to work in ag tech innovation, from engineering to agronomy to biology to computer science. This collaboration between Western Grower members, partners, and California educators will ensure growers and ag tech companies get access to the most highly skilled graduates in the nation. Curriculum development will begin immediately and will be fully implemented by June of 2025. Western Growers will provide a preview of the Next Gen Ag Workers curriculum at three upcoming events as part of its Ag Tech X Ed initiative. The next event will be held January 26th at Imperial Valley College. The event will feature panels on industry issues and skill identification, education, and workforce development strategies, a roundtable with agricultural CEOs, and a fireside chat with CDFA Secretary Karen Ross. Western Growers will be holding additional AgTech X Ed summits during 2022 at Hartnell College and Woodlands College. The first week-long Next Gen Ag Worker Summit is being planned for the summer of 2022 at Santa Clara University. In an organic market update from Organic Produce Network, organic Brussels sprouts from Mexico will return to consistent supplies after some interruptions in harvest and packing, as well as freight difficulties during the holidays. Pricing will be elevated this month with lighter supplies and strong demand, but it is expected to be short-lived as seasonal shippers begin their programs. Organic Brussels sprouts will be in mesh bags later this month. Organic greens and lettuce from Florida remain in strong production with quality at its peak and pricing promotions available. Organic romaine hearts and organic iceberg. Organic romaine hearts and organic iceberg lettuce from SoCal Yuma growing regions are in steady production, but little price relief because demand remains strong. Quality, availability, and pricing will all be steady for the next several weeks. Organic heirloom and a popular dark loam tomato volumes out of Central Mexico are coming on strong. Quality is excellent. Volume should allow for affordable pricing for much of January. Florida-grown organic grape tomatoes show steady with production for early January. Florida-grown organic grape tomatoes show steady with outstanding quality. Organic cherry, rainbow cherry, and gold grape tomatoes are available from Florida with good supplies and quality. Organic beefsteak and cluster tomatoes continue with steady availability from Mexico. One of Quebec's main greenhouse growers will have a gap in production, which is impacting the overall price. Organic Roma tomatoes remain steady and are just starting to drop in price as Mexico production continues to ramp up, and quality has been excellent. Organic color bell peppers from Mexico have begun to see strong harvests with promotional opportunities available. Organic green peppers from Florida are at peak supplies with quality and availability expected to remain strong in January. Organic mini sweet peppers from Florida are also seeing steady supplies and outstanding quality. Organic Mexican mini sweet peppers are beginning to see production strengthen with pricing and availability expected to improve. Mexico fair trade organic chili peppers are coming into season with Anaheim, Cherry Bomb, and Serrano varieties, with Florida organic jalapeno also available. Colder weather in early January delayed some harvest, but should not affect supplies. Quality and availability should remain strong, with slight price increases expected later in this month. Recently, President Joe Biden announced his intent to appoint 8 U.S. Department of Agriculture regional positions, including 5 Farm Service Agency state executive directors and 3 rural development state directors. For the state of California, Blong Jiang has been appointed as a Farm Service Agency state executive director. He served as the executive director for the Asian Business Institute and Resource Center. Elected in 2006, he served 2 terms as a council member for the city of Fresno, where he was the first elected Hmong council member in the state of California and the first Asian council member for the city of Fresno. Xiang also served as the deputy director for the Fresno Center, formerly known as the Fresno Center for New Americans. Additionally, he sat on several commissions and boards: the Asian Pacific Islander Commission, the California Volunteer Commission, the Insurance Diversity Board, and the Valley Small Business Development Corporation.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Being a member of the California walnut industry means working together to advance the industry through advocacy, research programs, and promoting walnuts with smart, cost-effective marketing. Learn more at walnuts.org.
Amid talks of climate change and a future of electric vehicles, a recent forecast suggests 2023 U.S. oil production will surpass the 2019 record. The U.S. Energy Information Administration released the forecast this week predicting U.S. oil production will average 12.4 million bushels a day in 2023. EIA Acting Administrator Steve Nally says they expect global demand for petroleum products to return to and surpass pre-pandemic levels this year, but crude oil production grows at a faster rate than in their forecasts. The forecasts predict U.S. crude oil production will increase for 9 consecutive quarters from the fourth quarter of 2021 through 2023. EIA also expects OPEC to increase its crude oil production to 28.9 million barrels per day in 2023, up from an average of 26.3 million barrels per day in 2021. EIA forecasts that U.S. commercial crude oil inventories will reach 465 million barrels at the end of 2023, about 11% more than the end of 2021. A North Dakota farm filed a class action lawsuit last Wednesday alleging John Deere is violating the Sherman Act in not making diagnostic software available to farmers who want to repair their own equipment. The lawsuit filed in a U.S. District Court for the District of Northern Illinois alleges John Deere has monopolized the repair service market for John Deere brand agricultural equipment with onboard central computers known as engine control units. Forest River Farms in North Dakota asked for a trial by jury and wants the court to order John Deere to make the necessary
necessary software available to individual farmers and repair shops. In addition, the lawsuit seeks damages for farmers who have paid for repairs from John Deere dealers beginning on January 12th of 2018 to the present.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.